Welcome to the debrief, everybody. Yet another hearing today in the Florida prosecution of the young man accused of murder over the Parkland High School shooting. Attorneys for Nicholas Cruz say it's unfair to force his trial to begin in January with drastically less preparation time than most other death penalty cases. The state says the chief trial judge in Broward County, Florida, designated the Cruz matter a priority. The defense says that's a mischaracterization of the record. The defense says it's struggling to go through the evidence which has been turned over and that the state hasn't turned over some materials from the investigation.
Repeatedly throughout the pendency of this case, the state of Florida has made representations that there are 7, 8, 9 public defenders that are on this case. There are 4 attorneys, Judge, 2 of which have filed notices of appearance. So this representation by the state that they know more about who is doing what in our case is inaccurate. I want the court to know that there are 4 assigned attorneys. That's it. There's nobody else full-time on this case. Do we employ the services of other individuals in our office? Absolutely. The same way that the state attorney's office does. So I just want the court to be fully aware of who comprises the defense team on a full-time basis. We're doing everything we can to proceed on this case. I have never had a capital case where there has been a date certain when we're still doing discovery. I'm not saying that we can't have an ideal date to look towards. I get that. It encourages all the parties to work together, which I believe we have been doing with the state of Florida and the court. But when you mentioned the date of January, we just said it's not a realistic date, and it turns out it's not. We just want to set something that's reasonable. We don't want this to go into 2021 unless it has to, Judge. We would like to have this case resolved by the end of next year. That is our goal. It has always been our goal. So we're not asking for infinity, Judge. We understand that this needs to be resolved.
The defense said it planned to call experts to testify about why the case should be delayed, but the scheduling of today's hearing so close to the holidays made that difficult. The defense also says Cruz's admission does not make the case easier to try.
The state says that this is not a complex case. And the basis for that is because there's an admission and because his guilt is evident, or whatever their exact language is. That is not relevant to whether a case is complex. Judge, any capital case, and the Supreme Court has said that, Florida Supreme Court has said that, the ABA has said that, all of the experts that we've provided affidavits from discuss the complexity of capital cases. They are all complex, and this case, even more so, based on the media attention and the impact on the community, will require more strategies and motions to eliminate any hindrance of his fair trial.
The judge is pushing Cruz's trial for allegedly assaulting a jail guard forward for January, but is pushing off the actual murder trial related to the Parkland shooting. 3 attorneys are with us here on the debrief. Let's begin with Jessica Ramirez. So, Jessica, the defense wanted about another year for the murder case, but the judge said maybe next summer, not the full year. Is that fair?
I think it is fair, definitely. I mean, it is a very complex case. 17 people died. There's, a lot of media attention. And as lawyers, we have to make sure we're representing our client in the fairest possible way and going through all the evidence. And we don't want to, be hit with ineffective assistance of counsel. So I think it was fair, and it's exactly what needed to be done.
Brian Buckmeyer, let's talk about a case with this many victims. It's horrific to think of the shooting, but from a trial preparation strategy, you have a lot of victims and you have a state that allows pretrial depositions. Not every state allows that, and the defense obviously wants to do a deposition of every single witness that's going to be called here.
Exactly. So what I tell a lot of people, and as our resident public defender, we don't have that name just for the fun of it. When we represent any client, we represent all clients. And so in representing Nicholas Cruz, we want to make sure that even if it is very simple for the prosecution, every T needs to be crossed and every I needs to be dotted, because when we do this job, we're protecting more than just our client. We're protecting the Sixth and the Fifth Amendment.
And remember, Brian, the defense at one point said, look, we're willing to plead guilty here to try to avoid the death penalty. The state just wouldn't hear it.
You're kind of putting it on the prosecution of them, saying, hey, we're trying to play ball here. It's just that they took away the stick, the ball, and the field. And so you're really trying to show to the judge that you're doing your due diligence and trying to help judicial economy as best as possible.
Mike Korobanik, death penalty changes everything here. It changes the trial preparation. It changes the types of motions that need to be filed. Talk about that for a second.
Well, sure, we have to go through many experts, mitigation. You have to look at your client. You have to look at all the autopsies of each one of these people. That's 17 different experts, probably. The thing is, the judge could say what the judge wants to say, but good luck with not trying it in a year, because I think you have to take it one step at a time and control the dates.
We might be right back here, as the defense says, having another hearing like this next year. We will see. New reports of missing jailhouse video and the purported suicide of millionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. Federal prosecutors told a judge they cannot find recordings from outside Epstein's cell the day before his first suicide attempt. That's according to TMZ. This footage would have shown what happened 2 weeks before his actual death. The issue came up when Epstein accused his cellmate, a former police officer, of attacking him. The cellmate said Epstein was lying, that he, the cellmate, actually tried to save Epstein. With no video and no Epstein, there appears to be no evidence to further investigate the cellmate. Two jail guards have pleaded not guilty to charges of wrongdoing at the facility where Epstein died. People magazine is reporting that actress Lori Loughlin believes she's the victim in a college admissions cheating scandal that's moving through federal court. A source tells the magazine that Loughlin feels, quote, hoodwinked by Rick Singer, the alleged mastermind of the scheme. The source's claim is similar to what we read in court documents filed last week by the defense, which suggests Loughlin and her fashion designer husband believe the money they forwarded to get their daughters into college was a legitimate donation to the institution, not a bribe. She thought she was doing the right thing, the magazine quotes the source. She believes that she is innocent and that the evidence in court will prove that. So let's go back to our panel of attorneys on this one. Jessica, I want to talk about criminal intent here. So can she logically argue that she had no intent to commit the crimes she's accused of committing? She just intended a donation, not a bribe of an official.
She can argue all she wants. It's going to be very interesting to see telephone records, any emails, any conversations that she had with this person to see if a reasonable person really does believe that she didn't know. I think that, it's a very scary argument for her, because she's really relying on what conversations took place, if any, with this person. And I don't know, he's already pled guilty, and he probably would have exonerated her if this was the case.
Brian, how's this going to roll out when it goes to trial here? Are we going to see other people that have been caught up in this testifying against Lori Loughlin saying, oh, no, this was a bribery scheme? Are they going to try to throw her under the bus?
Yeah, she's really walking on a razor's edge. Again, to Jessica's point, it's going to come down to all the communications. If there's anything that shows an absolute smoking gun, she's dead in the water. But then you can also go to the circumstantial evidence. It's similar to petty larceny and possession of stolen property cases, where my clients say, hey, I bought an 80-inch TV for $20. I thought it was legit. And we're all like, no, that's not how it works. And that might be something similar with Lori Loughlin.
Hey, I want to go to the store that sells TVs for that price. Mike Korobanix, you're a former prosecutor here. So how do prosecutors try to counter this claim that she thought this was a legitimate donation?
Maybe show her daughter's Instagram account and see how she
You think that's the evidence right there?
Well, I think, yeah. Sometimes the truth's in the humor. Yeah, but that's exactly the point. How could she possibly say, with the business and money they had, that she thought these were legitimate donations when her child was out there in the public saying she really didn't even want to go to school or go to classes, and she gets into a competitive school like that?
Yeah, this is going to be interesting to see exactly how Rick Singer plays into this. Will he testify? Will he not? Is she going to try to throw him under the bus? Is she going to blame him completely? So many moving parts to that case that we continue to follow. R&B singer R. Kelly is pleading not guilty to his latest federal charge. The artist appeared remotely from a Chicago courtroom for his arraignment that was actually in New York. He just wasn't there for it. He's accused of bribing an official to obtain a fake ID for a marriage license in 1994. The charge is part of a superseding indictment in the singer's racketeering case, and it's believed to be related to his secret marriage to singer Aaliyah when she was 15 years old. R. Kelly's attorneys reportedly told reporters after the hearing that the singer is now writing uplifting lyrics in jail. He's scheduled to go to trial for the racketeering case in May. Rap artist Tekashi 6ix9ine today learned he will not be going home from jail. This actually was yesterday, sorry about that. But will instead spend about a year in federal prison. Final punishment for this rap artist, 24 months behind bars. The judge gave Tekashi credit for 13 months. he's already served. Then it's 5 years of supervised release, no criminal activity, no guns, no drugs. The judge also ordered 300 hours of community service, a $35,000 fine, and an $800 special assessment. The judge said that unlike most defendants, Tekashi 6ix9ine can surely afford to pay. The sentencing capped the rapper's case involving crimes the judge summed up as selfish, reckless, destructive, sustained, and violent. Here's a look at Tekashi 6ix9ine's legal troubles.
The rapper, whose music earned him nearly 9 million YouTube subscribers and close to a billion downloads just for one song, has a troubled legal history.
I don't really want no friends now.
Tekashi 6ix9ine, whose real name is Daniel Hernandez, admitted to 9 federal racketeering and weapons charges. He admitted to robbing people at gunpoint, admitted to drug trafficking, and said, I paid a person to shoot a rival gang member to scare him and to increase my own standing in the gang. Tekashi 6ix9ine did what many defendants do. Facing a maximum of 47 years in prison, he flipped, hoping his cooperation would help lighten his own sentence. So, he testified for 3 days against 2 other alleged gang members, Anthony Ellison and El Jeremiah Mack, and helped prosecutors score convictions. While testifying, Tekashi 6ix9ine claimed fellow rappers Jim Jones and Cardi B were also gang members. Cardi B admitted gang involvement in a 2018 GQ interview, but said Tekashi 6ix9ine's testimony was not true.
Queens, Brooklyn.
But his rap sheet, dating back to 2015, includes a guilty plea for using a child in a sexual performance. His sentence back then was 1,000 hours of community service. He also was arrested on charges he choked a 16-year-old boy. Still, Tekashi 6ix9ine hoped for leniency. In a letter to his judge, he said, I am remorseful for what happened because I was blessed with the gift of an opportunity that most people dream of, but I squandered it by getting involved with the wrong people. He also said he feared gang retaliation.
I want to look at this from another angle with everyone here tonight. So, Brian, the fear of retaliation was part of what we heard yesterday in that hearing. The judge told Tekashi 6ix9ine, if you fear for your safety, I'll do anything in my power to protect you. So should this rap artist be asking for protection when he's released, and what can the judge do?
He should definitely be fearful of retaliation. If I was him, I wouldn't hang around with anyone wearing red. I would definitely stick around with anyone wearing any of the different color. He not only snitched on 2 people directly, but also started pointing fingers randomly. He kind of broke the one and only code that a lot of gang members have. And again, I think that everyone understands that, and he should be fearful, especially because he's such an iconic person.
Look, he was upset yesterday in court. I was sitting a couple of rows behind him in that hearing. He was upset that he's got to serve another year, but the judge said, hey, look, other people would be serving 8 years, 10 years or more for these sorts of crimes. Mike Korobanics, the attorneys also had the option to ask for special protection in prison. They were going to argue that through paperwork, not right there out in the open in court, because then everybody would know what that special protection might be. So again, should he receive that special protection?
Well, I think that's up to the Bureau of Prisons. They're going to make that decision. They don't want to put any prisoner in any sort of danger. So that'll be something that'll be done administratively. I don't think it's as big a deal as his lawyers are making up, because that goes in the process.
So, Jessica, let's say Tekashi 6ix9ine gets out of prison, resumes his career, which is what he's promising, which is what everyone expects will happen. And he has said he's going to reform his way. So can he go out there again and record explicit lyrics, songs about gangs, songs about crime, and still be ethically honest with his promise yesterday, which was lengthy, to reform himself and serve as a role model for others so they won't get caught in this trap, which is what the defense said was happening to him?
No, he's going to have a really hard time if he does that, absolutely. And I think that the world is going to not let him forget it and will bring it up. And, you know, I think that I know he's gotten a bad rap for snitching, but, you know, these people tried to kill him. They tried to kill him. He was funding their operation. He was giving up all his money. So I don't see it so much as snitching. They tried to kill him. So he is telling on people that told on him. And I think that, yeah, the world is not going to let him forget.
Well, look, you know, one thing the judge did not want to hear out of the defense yesterday was this claim that he got caught up in this underworld. The judge said, no, you were the ringleader. I'm not buying that excuse. Well, still ahead tonight here on The Debrief, a verdict in the case of a state trooper shot in the face. He survived, and you know him from the hit show Live PD. That case and that verdict in just a moment. Welcome back, everyone. The Law and Crime Network is devoting a full hour to examining the upcoming criminal prosecution of former movie producer Harvey Weinstein. One of Weinstein's accusers is his former assistant. She alleges Weinstein assaulted her in 1998 in her hotel room at the Venice Film Festival. Weinstein has reportedly claimed the encounter was consensual.
Well, I think there were a couple of nights at the Venice Film Festival where I was alone with Harvey in his hotel room. And, you know, that's really the point of the greatest risk and danger to a young woman that works for Harvey. I mean, there, I think there is a certain level of public abuse that you get, you know, the kind of screaming and the things being thrown. Now, that all happens with other people in the room. But I think the actual, you know, sexual misbehavior typically only takes place when you're alone in the room. It could be early in the morning. It could be late at night. But those are the times when it is definitely most challenging to kind of avoid and try to persuade Harvey to kind of back off. And those are difficult because there are no other witnesses there. I mean, he's not a foolish person. He's not going to try this on with several people in the room.
Law and Crime's Jesse Weber hosts the full hour-long special tomorrow at 11 o'clock Eastern on the Law and Crime Network. An Arizona jury has reached a partial verdict after 4 days in the shooting of a Live PD trooper. He was shot in the face. James Casey survived that attack, which by process of elimination, authorities pinned on defendant Ramon Bueno. Bueno was in the back seat of a car trooper Casey pulled over for having tinted windows. Three others were in that car, and the defense suggested someone else could have shot trooper Casey. Here, however, is the jury's decision.
We, the jury, duly impaneled and sworn in the above entitled action, upon our oaths, do unanimously find the defendant as to count one, attempt to commit first degree murder, impasse, signed, foreperson. Count two, aggravated assault, to wit, James Casey, guilty, signed, foreperson. Count three, aggravated assault, to wit, Ronaldo Cruz, guilty. Count four, aggravated assault, to wit, Mike Alfano, guilty. Count five, drive-by shooting, guilty. Count six, threatening or intimidating, to wit, James Casey, guilty. Count seven, threatening or intimidating, to wit, Ronaldo Cruz, guilty. Count eight, threatening or intimidating, to wit, Mike Alfano, guilty. Signed, foreperson.
Late yesterday, the jury was deadlocked 11-1 in favor of guilt on the top charge there. The jurors in that moment came back with this question.
We seem to be at an impasse on count one, with the sticking point being whether or not Officer Casey was struck by the first shot being fired. The prosecution called an eyewitness, Mr. Sunderland, who we believe testified that his back was turned to the incident when he heard a shot, presumably the first shot. When he turned and went closer, he saw all three officers still standing. And then, after further fire, he saw the officer, quote, go down, close quote. To our recollection, the prosecution did not challenge that. Can we have access to the notes taken when he, and I read that he to be Mr. Sunderland, was interviewed in 2014, or his testimony transcript? Or can you give us some other help with this issue?
It's the testimony from a man who was staying at the Knights Inn where the shooting happened that seems to have confused the jury. The witness described hearing his dog growling at 1:30 in the morning and seeing a squad car which had pulled over a vehicle. Here is some of what the jury asked to see again.
So as I was entering my room, I heard a gunshot go off, and I turned around and actually ran with my dog all the way down to the balcony and to see what was going on. They had a dark burgundy Toyota Camry, Honda, whatever you want to call it, but it was a small four-door vehicle, and they had just pulled it over, and they were actually going back and forth with gunshots. I know there was gunshots coming from the vehicle that they had pulled over, and then there were three officers behind that vehicle who were shooting back. In the middle of all that going down, one of the officers actually got hit in the face or got shot and went down to the ground. He looked like he was alive still. So the other two officers were actually trying to get him out of the line of fire, but the guys in the burgundy vehicle were actually just kept on shooting. Eventually, they ended up peeling out, and the other two officers managed to get the downed officer out of the way. And then from that point on, everything, I just kind of went back to my room.
Jessica, Brian, and Mike are here one final time. So Mike Korobanek's former prosecutor, current defense attorney, the jury was stuck on an interesting issue here and ultimately, apparently, was still stuck on it all the way to the end.
It's amazing, Aaron. It goes like we talk a lot of times. You can prepare your defense or prosecution any way you want. You just don't know what weight that jury, that particular jury, is going to give that particular witness. I thought this to be a non-witness as far as importance in the ranking. He was down low.
Well, basically, the jury found that he was really important. And Jessica, why stick on this issue of whether or not it was the top charge, whether it was attempted murder, if then you're going to find that that defendant is the one who actually did pull the trigger?
Well, I think that everybody knows the attempted murder charge, well, could lead to a death sentence. And I think just going back to this witness, although you said that he's probably a non-important witness, I think that this witness had nothing to gain out of being and testifying. So I think that's why he became very important, because out of all the parties here, he had nothing to lose, he had nothing to gain. He was just really there going to tell the truth.
See, here's the thing, though, Brian Buckmeyer, if somebody hypothetically, okay, shoots a trooper in the face and the jury agrees that the defendant is the one who pulled the trigger, they convicted him of pulling the trigger across the board here, then why not just reach the top charge? Because what the defense was contesting here was whether or not he even was the one who pulled the trigger, not the level of culpability that should be attached to it.
I think this is a compromise to allow all 12 people to go home. I think we're stuck on 11-1, and the compromise was that, hey, we will pass over on the murder one, and we will convict on the rest, because if you go with the storyline, as you're alluding to, Aaron, it really...
Okay, so we're wrapping up, running out of time here. Big question as to whether or not the state is going to try to go for that top charge again. It might depend on the sentencing. Thanks a lot to the panelists. We're out of time, as I said. We'll see you tomorrow here on the Daily Debrief at 5 o'clock Eastern, live on the Law and Crime Network.